Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about jobs in D&D. Do your player characters need day jobs? Are side skills a good background element? Should they buy a tavern or run a merchant business? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into the discussion about jobs or other forms of occupation in D&D and other role-playing games, I want to take a moment to remind our listeners that at the end of the show, as always, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I over on our Discord server. And you can join in by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms and you'll get an invite to that Discord server. You'll be able to join us around maybe 10 after 2 Eastern time. We should be on there to continue the discussion about jobs in D&D.
We would love to see you there. So I think, Paul, I think my opening bid here today will be, get a job, you murder hobos!
It's such an interesting topic, and I think you and I both have a lot of research and a lot of materials here to share on it.
We do.
And it's I feel like it's just a thing that seems to always naturally happen. I think I've run plenty of campaigns where the players inevitably, either because of downtime, oh, we've got like a month in town because maybe one player wants to do something and you've said, okay, we're just going to fast forward through a month of time. What's everyone do? Or because like the players are trying to find a sink to all the money that they've come across and they say, we always seem to hang out at this bar. Let's just buy it. Right? Or let's buy a house or a castle or a something, and then suddenly they get sucked into the management and whatnot of that stuff.
Right.
This meshes a little bit with one of our previous topics on skills when we were discussing skills, because if you go back when we were talking about the history of skills, we started at second edition AD&D's non-weapon proficiencies, which I pointed out in that discussion, like they're very kind of craft oriented, right? There's a lot of things like brewing and baking and, Bower Fletcher and weaponsmithing and blacksmithing and all this kind of crafting of making of equipment, which you got to assume is going to lead you down the path of like, well, then I should sell that stuff, right? Now I've got a job.
Definitely. And, it's funny because I'll contrast some of those mechanics that when I'm running basically original D&D, obviously original D&D had none of that. Your career is fighter or magic user or cleric. That's everything in the game right there. You can hire other people, right? There's actually, if you are have a castle, you can hire, there's clearly a list of you can hire henchmen. That's part. You can hire an alchemist or an assassin. But when I actually start like a low-level D&D game, my opening pitch is very specifically that the player characters don't have jobs and that they're in an economic situation whereby they're desperate and they don't have any prospects for dependable employment. So either they are like a young son of a knight that doesn't have any land in their name, or they're a veteran soldier, and unfortunately, peace has come to the land, and you don't have any mercenary now, right? And because of that, you're actually in dire straits, and you're not sure how you're going to feed yourself next.
Yeah.
And usually, I pitch that as the driving force for why you have to go tomb robbing, specifically because you don't have other employment opportunities. So it's kind of interesting that you're right that once they actually do get some money, I don't know, like if in my campaigns that gives extra motivation to try to find some kind of dependable position after the fact, because that's actually how I open all my D&D campaigns is you don't have a job and you can't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, I think when we get into, especially the style, I think, Dan, that you and I prefer of the setting for D&D, of this kind of, you know, a little more gritty, you know, swords and sorcery type thing, where the players are more likely to be kind of ne'er-do-wells, right? Or at least self-serving individuals rather than, you know, noble world savers, right? Like, I don't know, if you go to Tolkien, you could like scratch your head over what is the career path of the hobbits or the, you know, Aragorn. I mean, I guess your options were, I don't know, what, farmer, noble, or maybe knight or warrior or something like that, right? It's sort of where they were at. But if you look at stories you know, more of the pulp, in the pulp section, you know, we'd look at like Fafnir and the Grey Mouser or Conan. And yeah, they're just, a lot of their adventures are, they're essentially get rich quick schemes, right? They're, they have no viable source of income. And they're just like, how do we, what can we do to, you know, scrape together some cash?
Totally.
Yeah. So that's certainly the angle that I'm coming from it as well. Yeah. So having the characters establish, yes, I have this other day job that supplies income and supplies a living, does seem a little contrary to the main theme of the game, which is treasure hunting.
Right. Right. I agree. There's clearly, at the very least, a tension between those things.
Yeah. Now, like, as I mentioned, this has come up organically for me in a couple different D&D campaigns, and it usually focuses around something like the players start to get into some money, and then they, you know, they say, well, you know, we always seem to hang out at this tavern, let's just buy it, or something like that, right? It's sort of like early, low-level domain play almost, right? I'm getting ready for eventually, someday I'm going to control a barony, for now I'm just going to control a tavern.
Right.
And you and I have seen this, right? We've played in a campaign together where our characters did exactly that, right? Bought a tavern, you know, just to fill with our trophies. I don't think we ever like really considered it a job or ever worried about like you know, how much money it produced, right? It was just a place for us to put our trophies and for us to, you know, sleep when we were in town.
True. True. The show started here. I asked Paul, I was like, my memory's a little hazy. Have I seen this in a game before? And Paul says, no, we've done that. We did that. I'm like, right. I had this really familiar image of the, like, we hang out in the tavern, we're going to buy the tavern. Like, well, that was us.
Yeah. And it's a little adjacent to, like, I've also had player groups who, like, you know, maybe they buy a house, right? They're like, okay, well, I'm just going to buy a house in this village, you know, and that's going to be my home, because why do I keep staying at taverns and inns? I can just own a house. The nice thing about that is that becomes usually more of a money sink than a money producer, right? Then they're like, okay, well, if you're keeping all your treasure in your house, it's going to get robbed while you're out treasure hunting, right? Oh no, now I got to hire guards and I got to, you know, build, you know, better security for my treasures that I've gained. But
that actually happened in my last campaign. You know, my players, you know, bought exactly a house, and then they had to hire a major domo, and now they're like, where, you know, tell me, you know, it was operating, like, design the vault in the basement with the traps that you have to, mm-hmm. you know, protect your various treasures, and that became an element. So yeah, that it totally, again, particularly in classic D&D, where the game is driven on getting experience from treasure, you wind up getting these giant mounds of treasure in the zone prior to you being able to actually build a full-blown castle. And there is kind of an obvious desire to kind of ramp up, as I think you're saying, Paul, into something that kind of looks a little bit like mini domain play.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the area for me where this has hit a lot more, though, than D&D is Warhammer Fantasy. So I've played a lot of Warhammer Fantasy RPG, and in fact, we had a streamed campaign of it here on the channel for several years called 10 Dead Rats. And the idea of, like, what your job is, or as they call it, career, is just completely systemized into Warhammer Fantasy. Okay. I have here... here's a clip from the first edition Warhammer Fantasy RPG, and I know it's probably a little hard to read because there's very small text here. But it's both a section on describing basic careers and then an alphabetical list of careers. And it tells me, the part that I've highlighted here, it says, remember, however, that a basic career is not necessarily the career that the character is to follow from now on. It is more an indication of the life the character has lived up until now. right? So it has this premise of like, okay, you gave this up, right? You had this career. This is just background information about your character. You were doing this thing. And you know, the funny thing is, like, there's a lot of random stuff on here and some stuff that makes sense to like go on to become an adventurer, because you have things like I was a soldier, or I was a smuggler, or just picking stuff out here at random, right? I was a coachman, like, I don't know, I was a pit fighter, right? Sort of stuff that kind of, right, that sort of says, yeah, okay, I could see how that would, you know, evolve into like treasure hunting. But then there's other stuff that that I mentioned, like coachman, or I'm a jailer, or I'm a road warden, or a scribe. Seeing, right, where you're like,
I'm seeing mule skinner. Like, how would that?
Well, the funny thing is, and I feel like second edition Warhammer leans into this a little bit more, where the list. Do I have the list of careers? I don't have that one here. With the list of careers, especially basic careers that you start off with, were really terrible, right? There were things like, I'm a rat catcher, I'm a bone picker, I'm a grave robber, yeah. Right? They were just like, yeah, these are definitely the kinds of, you know, careers where you would say like, you know what, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way for me to get some money, you know, than grave robbing. So you can kind of see, like, that at least makes sense, right? Of that method of, you know, that sort of like, just this is just background, right?
Yes. And,
but the interesting thing, let me see if I can get up the. Sorry, I have so many.
While you're doing this, I'm attracted to tollkeeper. I'm thinking of a character that was a tollkeeper, and someone wants some particular person jump the toll, and they've taken an oath, a lifelong oath, to track down and take revenge on the toll jumper.
I mean, I do dig this stuff as background-y things, right? Like, it gives your character an interesting hook to start out with, right? Like, I like that. I think that's fun. And I think we were just talking earlier about how DCC kind of co-opted this a little bit, right? So DCC now has a list of careers that you can roll on. And it's just for flavor, I think, right? Is that all it does? It just gives you a little,
It does give you, like, one starting mundane implement, as I was looking at. Because you had to remind me about this. I played in a DCC campaign for a couple of years, and I didn't remember this. So it's a bit of, and, you know, it kind of is reflective of the secondary skills idea from early D&D that we were looking at last time. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's, I mean, at least from the beta rules PDF that I'm always working with, here's the DCC occupation list. And so roll percentiles, you get a similar kind of background, farmer, gambler, jeweler, locksmith, mercenary, stuff like that. And you get, it specifies one weapon that you're trained with, which is frequently a staff or a club or a dagger. And you get one trade good, one extra thing that you're carrying around, which could be a spyglass or a shoehorn or a barrel or a lantern. Or if you're a farmer, there's a footnote. I think it's the farmer. You get a hen, and then there's a footnote that says if you have more than one farmer in your party, roll on this extra secondary table to make sure there's no duplicates. And then you might have a sheep or a goat or a cow or a duck or something like that, right? So it's clearly something that's not really adventuring gear. And as soon as you get legitimate armor, legitimate weapon, you're basically going to forget about this. But I am kind of recollecting the very first session. It was like, how am I going to use the hen? Right.
That's great. I mean, this is, in fact, our campaign and the rules that I wrote for it called 10 Dead Rats comes from the same concept, that the rat catcher career in Warhammer Fantasy, all the careers come with trappings, as they call them, things, equipment that you get for free for having that background career. Rat catcher being one of the most amusing and evocative and like setting specific for Warhammer careers. People love to focus on it. One of the trappings that it came with was a stick with 1d10 dead rats attached to it. So just I suppose, from your most recent rat catching. And that's kind of a play on an earlier rule set that someone else wrote that I took a lot of inspiration from, which was called Small but Vicious Dog, which was also on the trapping list for a rat catcher. You got a small but vicious dog.
That's really good, actually. That really tickles me for some reason.
A little bit vicious dog. But here's where it gets weird in Warhammer. So I want to dig into this because it's just so fascinating. And I have this kind of weird love-hate feeling about what Warhammer Fantasy RPG did here. So this is the section on adventuring careers. And it's talking specifically, the fact is, the whole point of the careers, besides giving you trappings in Warhammer Fantasy, is it also gives you which skills you get access to and what skills you can buy advances in as your character advances. And then eventually, once you fill out that career, you're expected to then move on to a new career, an advanced career, or possibly a different basic career. Under adventuring careers, I've highlighted a couple lines here. It talks about, it's giving an example of a character's career progression. And it says the initial career then is one she leaves behind as she embarks on her career as an adventurer. Great, got that. But then it says, mostly she will be self-employed, engaged in fighting the incursions of chaos, and hopefully leading an exciting and profitable life at the same time. So it's kind of trying to find that balance of like talking about like how, yeah, you're going to, you're going to have this, you're going to leave this behind, right? You're going to go adventuring. The expectation is you're going to go adventuring. You're not going to partake in this career all the time. But then later, she becomes a mercenary. And then from here, she becomes a mercenary sergeant or a mercenary captain. And each time she will seek out her new trappings, look for work in her new role, and start filling out the additional advances the job confers. And it gets weird here because the advanced careers start to become like interesting and powerful and certainly remunerative. So like you feel like,
I see, yep.
Like you feel this pressure that you want to, that you want to include this in the role play, right? So I'm jumping around a little bit here, but here's a section from second edition Exciting. Warhammer Fantasy. I was looking for places in the text where they actually address the push-pull here of adventuring versus the career path. So this is a section from second edition Warhammer Fantasy. It says, you should keep in mind that you are living the adventurer's life. You travel quite a bit. You may not even have a permanent home. Your new career needs to work with this lifestyle. You can't become the steward of a castle and then simply leave for 6 months. You should work with your GM to determine what works for the specifics of your campaign. A sergeant would be easy to integrate into a military-based campaign, for instance, but less so into one that centers on courtly intrigue. Right? And this is the problem, right? So I got into this many times while playing Warhammer in that each player maybe starts with these weird evocative things, and there are a bunch of ne'er-do-wells, and great, we've got a bone picker and a rat catcher and a messenger, right? Just people with these odd jobs who band together to go make it big. But then each one of them starts down these paths of becoming these other things. One's on track to become a mercenary captain. One's on track to become an innkeeper. And like as GM, I found this was really hard to juggle, right? The text right here is telling me you work with your GM to determine this, how your career integrates with the campaign. And that sounds great from the player's perspective, but as GM, you're doing this for 4 to 6 people with very different wants and desires, and it's just going to push your campaign into this very difficult space, I think.
I'm totally familiar with it. Yeah, trying to take, I mean, that's one example on the page there, but take that constraint times 6, and I can totally see you having an empty intersection of what everybody is pursuing. And it feels very familiar to the promise in classic D&D of you're going to graduate to this domain level play. And, you know, and with like outdoor spoliation, I've totally struggled with the concept of how does your 6-person or whatever party function as an oligarchical, you know, group running a domain, which really doesn't make sense in a lot of different ways. It really doesn't make sense historically, and it really doesn't make sense on just a simple command and control level of, you know, normally an army in the field or a ship at sea has one captain, they're the leader. That's just how things work and make sense. And it's a real struggle to convert your game, how you evolve your game with this group aspect into that same higher level problem in which it seems like they should all be going in their different directions.
Yeah. It's the one time I played a very long running Warhammer game where I was a player, I started out as a bone picker, but I was looking at my career path, and I can't remember where it was going, but some kind of merchant kind of career path is where I was headed. And so I made up this whole ridiculous thing where my character was essentially trying to build a better torch. I don't know why. That's what he landed on, right? He was trying to build a better torch, and he had this whole weird thing of building it out of bone rather than wood, and it would, since it was hollow, it could contain oil, and it was a very odd and convoluted thing planned for him, but it was in the name of like trying to explain the progression into this other career. And I had one of the other players kind of helping me with this, which was kind of fun that the two of us were trying to integrate our career paths. But ultimately it went nowhere, right? Because the GM, of course, was running this adventure, right? And was trying to give us adventures to go on and didn't want us to settle down and become, you know, inventors and merchants and professional torch makers, right? It's just like, it just was very counter to the content. And eventually I realized that I was just swimming upstream, and I was just like, oh, this is just silly. Why am I bothering with this?
We can sell you a sixth torch.
Yeah. Now it's interesting. Now, one of the things I want to call out here, though, is that mercantile nature. That is an interesting thing because I've seen that come up in play. Organically, again, without the career system aside. In fact, we can talk a little bit here about The Enemy Within, which is the big printed campaign for Warhammer, which of course is the basis for the content of Tented Rats and people. This is an absolutely adored campaign. The second, and we touched on this in the past, as I'm saying this out loud, now I'm realizing. I believe it's the second section, the second box set of the campaign focuses on the players obtaining a ship and starting to, or a boat, right, a river boat that they're using to move goods up and down the river, and then ostensibly get, you know, into trouble at every town they stop at, right? Every town has some adventure going on or something.
Yeah.
But the players are encouraged to like work the trade routes, right? To figure out like, oh, this town needs this resource and that town needs that resource, and we can box it up and ship it. And they're trying essentially to become merchants, right? They're trying to be merchants, but adventure continues to just push at them. And it's an interesting little bit of content, and frankly, one that when I ran it and every recounting I've read of other people running it, that GMs struggle with, because there's usually like one or two players that get super into it and want to try and figure out the best trade route. And then the remainder of the players are just bored and waiting for the next fun stuff to come up, because they're like, whatever, I don't care about the price of grain. Can we move on, please?
And I've run head on basically into the same problem with domain play in Outdoor Spoliation, one of the biggest farts of gaming that I've run in the last couple of years, honestly. I did not foresee that problem and just crap the bed as a result of that problem. Let me segue to someone who's had a good experience. So I will point out that kind of when we started the show here pretty soon, our viewer Josh, the very first thing he thought of was, I've had players in Traveler style games that do the merchant thing with their ship in fantasy. You've never got a crew that got that involved in running a business, which is kind of an interesting, you know, Traveler is a really interesting counterpoint, and me not having run it, we were talking about it last week with our skills episode that kind of overlaps a little bit with what we're talking today. And it's interesting that with Traveler, classic Traveler characters, the character is the entirety of the character is the background of the branches of the training that they took, and their skills and what the character essentially is the result of that background mini game, frankly. And the game, absolutely, I do feel, my understanding of Travelers, most commonly they get out of these training situations and then they're thrown into this indie freebooter wildcat merchant type situation. And for some reason we seem like we struggle with, it seems like that ought to work in fantasy, and it does seem like we struggle with that a little bit more.
And sorry, you've seen it work in Traveler, or you just know?
Well,
that
I hear about that as like the idiomatic gameplay of Traveler is sort of my sense of things.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder how much it is in actually digging into the mechanics of that and setting up a star system with different planets that have different needs, and actually having the players dig into the cost of, you know, luxury goods on this planet versus that planet versus just, again, just being the framework, right? Because I think if I look back at like the Enemy Within content, like the framework of it is fun, right? Yeah, we're all getting on our boat, and like we've heard we're going to make a bunch of money by picking up, you know, iron ore in this town and then moving on. We're going to ship it up to Altdorf and we're going to make a killing. And what I found in 10 Dead Rats and what ended up happening in 10 Dead Rats is I just invented an NPC to take care of this stuff for them.
Right.
The player's like, we like the concept. We enjoy the traveling around and trying to, like, you know, trade stuff, but I just don't want to be involved, just don't want to deal with all the nitty gritty of like, where can we bring this and figuring out what the best trade routes are and whatnot.
Right. You know, so William just made a comment here of saying in that difference between fantasy and sci-fi, I think part of it maybe goes back to the level of perceived social mobility in medieval fantasy versus industrialized sci-fi. That does sort of make sense. It seems like, you know, you can in modern sci-fi or whatever, you can strike it rich and now you're part of society because you're the nouveau rich and you're part of society. Whereas in medieval fantasy, if you are thinking about like a feudal nobility realm, you aren't just like turned into a noble normally. So I can see that as part of it. Let me
it's interesting because that, you know, wait, but that particular quote, I mean, it's funny because that very much borders on another quote that I had pulled off of our Discord server, in sort of the way that this intersects with skill systems, right? So in Warhammer, right, the entire purpose of these careers apparently, right, is that it grants access to specific skills. So you're saying like, oh, I want to be better at fighting, then I should go down the mercenary or soldier path because that gives me access to those skills.
Yeah.
And this is what we're discussing in the skills discussion is that like now you're kind of co-mixing a class system and a skill system and like intermingling those two things in our opinion, I think from that episode is that they don't really mix very well. And here, I just want to share this. I hope our Mr. Jordan's okay with me putting his text up here, but this was on our Discord server, and he posited that my guess is that due to our perception of social mobility in the society the game is simulating, when you're starting out your adventure as Boer, son of Boerson in the 14th century England analog world, you probably know the same stuff as all the other Boers past and present know, so you're in the Boer class. But in modern and future settings where lifelong careers are obsolete and everyone is a freelancer, you're going to be the sum of whatever useful skills you've managed to acquire while making ends meet.
Oh, interesting.
Which I thought was just very apt, you know.
That's a good observation.
There. And like, right? Yeah. Right? That's sort of like, and this is in addressing like, why do we see skill systems working or more present in fantasy or sci-fi type settings and then a class system in our fantasy? I think it's an interesting observation about maybe where they come from. But I think ultimately my takeaway is that like having both of them, they just clash, right? I think you want to pick one or the other.
Yeah.
Right? I would argue for, you know, as much as I enjoy the flavor that the career system gives you in Warhammer, that tying it to the advancement ladder of your character was maybe a poor choice.
I think that might be a good observation. That might be a mistake I could be prone to make. As I, like, if I think about classic D&D, I'm excited, like, with when they brought in the Druid class, which was a later addition. I was personally excited, but which was one of the first ones they did this with, it, that there was an implied social strata of, you know, at the upper levels, you actually had to go fight, you know, someone of higher level in order to achieve the next level. That was totally, and it seemed exciting and it seemed interesting world building, but you'd wind up in this exact same category of now the whole party has to go support the one character in the pursuit of their next level kind of thing. And I think I think I could make that same oversight actually of entangling the two, it feeling like a good idea and then it having disappointing results in the actual campaign.
Right. I feel like it shines in things like, say, Enemy Within, because the whole party is in on it, right? They're all like, yes, we found this boat. We have a boat. We're going to use it. We're going to, and it's got some trade goods on it, and let's go to town and sell those trade goods. And now we're getting sucked into being boat traders as a group, right? As opposed to, say, the career system in Warhammer, where I'm trying to pursue becoming a merchant, yeah, and you're trying to pursue, yeah, becoming a mercenary captain, and like we're both trying to push the campaign in radically different directions now.
I think that's a really good point. Let me now, one of the things I'll point to is when you start to bring those elements in, I think I'm personally realizing lately that there is a peril for the DM, is that the level of abstraction that you go into is really has a wide range of possibilities, and you might not realize in advance how many different levels of abstraction you could possibly go into that may or may not satisfy, you know, your one player who's really interested in it and your entire group at the party and you all communally at the same time. And let me contrast maybe at least two different systems. So in specifically for this issue that you're talking about, Paul, about being a merchant on a ship. So really early on, Dragon Magazine number 6 has a system for this. Like, this is super early. This is within 6 months of Dragon Magazine existing. This is back in 1977. This is my image with a red dot. And so this was an article by Ronald Spencer in 77 called Sea Trade in D&D Campaigns. And again, the text is really small, but I just wanted to give you a sense of it. You know, for what it's worth, Dragon articles at the time were really short. This whole article is just this one page. That's it. And it's actually, in some sense, it actually counts as a long article for the time. And so if you do dig up this article from issue 6 and look at the details, one interesting thing is that Ronald Spencer Jr. here is running a game on a U.S. nuclear submarine at the time, the USS Benjamin Franklin. And so he's actually running a game where everyone is a U.S. sailor at the time. And so they get a little advanced in levels, and a rather obvious thing that comes up is, can we run a ship? Right, which I'm kind of amused by. It's obvious, but yet they still have the taste of like, I want to spend my fantasy gaming talking about ships while we're on our ship. And so what they did here, and so specifically said, we have a fighter and he's kind of like Conan and he wants to do both. He clearly wants to keep roaming around the lands having adventures, but he also wants to have like some investments in a merchant. And so basically this system here is entirely abstract and meant to be handled basically off screen. So the one player character in question can give some orders. I want you to go 5 ports away and I want you to only accept a profit level of 20%. Basically, that's everything they're doing. And then off screen, the DM doesn't even ever specify specific cargoes. At no point is it even specified like what you're hauling. It's like your ship goes out, you pick a certain number of ports distance to go, there's a percentile roll, and that determines what your profit or loss is. And the further you go, the more risk you're taking and possibly the better result. Or possibly the more likelihood that you lose the ship. So this is a system here that's entirely abstract, never specifies exactly what you're carrying, and kind of makes sense if the character is an entirely uninvolved outside investor, right? Maybe that's what your characters want. We want something to put money into. We aren't really interested in the day-to-day management of it. Then that suggests one kind of system where it's highly abstract like that. That sort of makes sense.
Fascinating. Right? So I went digging for what D&D and what modern D&D does around this, because I thought, you know, you mentioned old school D&D doesn't have any of this, but I thought, you know, 5th edition surely does. And what we find is in 5th edition in the Dungeon Master's Guide under the section of between adventures, right, where they're talking about downtime activities that players can take in between adventures that are kind of generally tend to be off-screen kind of stuff, there is an entry in here for running a business. So how do you run a business? And I've just clipped some of the text here where it talks about, like, you know, you can end up owning a business that has nothing to do with delving into dungeons or saving the world. You might inherit a smithy or be given a parcel of farmland or a tavern, right? But then it goes on to just say, well, here's a chart. here's a chart, you know, figure out how many days in the downtime they spend dealing with this business, roll on the chart. I didn't include the chart here, but the chart is basically ranges from things like you have to pay a bunch of money because, you know, you end up in the red and it costs more to operate than it produces. Or on the other extreme, it covers all its own costs and makes a profit and you get this much money. And that's it. It's just a quick roll of the dice. Boom. Here's what your business did. Move on, please. And frankly, most of these choice. Downtime activities in the 5th edition DMG are like that. Yeah.
And again, it's interesting. It's an interesting addition because this is entirely absent in original D&D, entirely absent in 1st edition. The idea that the players would do anything respectable whatsoever, frankly, just wasn't in any of those books. So, that can make sense. I don't mind that system. That's smart.
I don't mind it, but I do like I find I do want to include little touches in. I would like it to affect the players' lives a little bit, and specifically what I'm talking about here is like I'm thinking about the enemy within campaign. Where yes, you know, I eventually just created an NPC, which was great. They could just talk to the NPC and say, you know, what are we carrying? What do we have room to carry? Where can we go?
Right.
But the nice thing about it was that I could use that as an excuse for the NPC to say, like, well, really, ideally, we should go to Altdorf because we're carrying all this copper and the price of copper in Altdorf is really soaring, right? Or even maybe a choice like, we should go either north or south, right? There's two extremes on the map. That's where we're going to get our best prices. Which would you prefer, players, that we do? Right. But the nice thing is it pushes them into a direction and a location. Right. Just like, say, owning a tavern, like, well, now there's a reason for the players to come back to this town frequently. Right. Even if I don't necessarily have to partake in the actual nitty gritty of maintaining the tavern, I still want to show up now and again to poke my nose in and be like, hey, how's it going? Give me my profits or let me pay for all the upkeep costs or whatever it is. Right.
Right.
So I like those little touches where it invades in the players' lives a little bit. But not to the exclusion of the main plot of whatever it is you're playing.
I agree. If I could, I'd like to look on that kind of level of abstraction. I'd like to look at, and as you know, I talk these days about the Star Frontiers campaign that I'm running. So just coincidentally, I didn't even know this was the topic for today, but coincidentally this week I was looking at the Star Frontiers Nighthawks campaign book, which was, you know, this was the box set that had spaceships, and along with it they had a campaign book. And written by Doug Niles, and they had I think it's like about a 6-page section called Economic Activity on the Frontier, and I think that it's tasteful. Honestly, I think that it's short enough. It gives, you know, a reasonable amount of detail for players setting up businesses that specifically run in space on spaceships. Pretty similar to like the Traveler merchant type of game. And so, like, if you pull up the image with the orange dot, right, they have specific tables. And the three things they point to are specifically, you could set up a civilian passenger line. They're, carrying people back and forth. You can set up a freighter line, which is what this table would be for, where you're taking either natural resource cargo between systems, or it could be, like, industrial equipment. There was a Dragon article that expanded it to like agricultural stuff, like wines and medicines and stuff. And so here is a system where, kind of like you're talking about, Paul, is at a particular system, you're more or less likely to have a different type of cargo, and you use percentile dice for a particular thing you're picking up. And there's a specific cost at the source, and there's a specific price you'd have at the destination. For what it's worth, you know, and then there's a footnote that says, you know, if you want to go into more complication, you could have surges, you could have gluts. That's, you know, we don't put that into our, you know, initial concise rule set. So I think it's pretty, you know, easy to understand at the outset. There's also setting up your own mining business and then possibly having complications on planet side as you're trying to mine one of these particular resources. There were a couple Dragon articles that expanded this into, you know, if you want more complication into the whole trading system, you could expand it. I feel like this is not bad. For my taste, like, I actually like things being a little bit more concrete like this. Like, I actually like knowing what the cargo is. And I feel that it's more interesting to say, we're hauling a cargo of uranium, or we're hauling a cargo of diamonds. We're hauling several metric tons of diamonds seems more interesting. And like you're saying a couple minutes ago, you can have the NPC can have a conversation about it. For me, it feels visceral. It catches my imagination a little bit more. If there's a pirate attack or something, you know what's at stake. So I think given my druthers, I kind of like having a little bit more specificity to it. But this assumes that the players are, more likely to be actually present, actually, running the ship, knowing it more or less. But it's still, that having been said, it's still a lightweight campaign. And then sure enough, just like you're saying, and Hoba Ogre said a second ago, he said, for PCs that run an off-screen business, just build an encounter table that includes maybe losing money or making money, something like that. And so in this system here, the image with the yellow dot, so for each of the three business ventures of passenger line, freighter, or mining, you get a little table. It's not huge. It's a little table. There's like five things that could happen. And so this here is, on one freighter run, you roll percentile dice, and maybe you might get attacked by pirates, you might have a mutiny, you might have technical trouble on the ship, you might get hassled by local militia at your destination, and then 90% of the time, you're perfectly fine, right? So I feel like this gives you quite a bit of play value of a little table with five possibilities. That's some stuff. You can get playing with that, and you know what? If it turns out that your players really love this action, you can expand the table later. I'm sure you'll get more creative ideas later on. But I agree that just a little bit of a random table like this for some, input-output effects gives it some nice flavor to get you started if you're going to go down that route. It doesn't have to be that complicated.
I want to go back. I want to look at your orange table here again about this is very interesting to me. Is the idea simply that I would just roll on this chart and this is what I end up with? Or am I trying to make a decision? Oh, I'd rather carry, platinum or salt or, zircon.
The core rule would be a relatively small number of star systems have natural resources. Mm-hmm. So you'd go to a star system and you would randomly roll for one of these things on a particular trip. This is what's currently available. An obvious refinement would be to say on a particular world, they only have this one or two or three things ever, but at least as a starting game, it is actually just roll the percentile on one particular trip to see what you get. Now, in other systems, they might be industrialized systems and they're producing tractors and trucks and hovercraft and jet copters and washing machines, right? And if you're at one of those systems and you roll on a different table to see what manufactured good you're carrying instead.
And then the destination, is that arbitrary? Does it matter? It doesn't matter where I'm taking the goods, wherever I unload them.
In the core game, it does not. Like I say, there was an expansion article in Dragon, I think about in 93, number 93, that had a larger table of what's available and what's imported and what's exported. And what and a chance to have a glut or a shortage, so that would be an expansion that someone wrote in an article.
Interesting, because that's where I ended up with in the 10 Dead Rats game. I had basically every town that was along the river system that they were traveling along. I had a list of here's this list of goods of what cost, how much they cost here. Right, that's just it. Just the current trading of leather in Bogenhofen is this much money. And then you could, if you looked at all this information, you could say like, oh, well, it goes for much cheaper in Bogenhofen than in Altdorf. So we should go to Bogenhofen, buy leather, then bring it to Altdorf and sell it there. And then maybe you also then start to think, well, then what can we buy in Altdorf? And you'd start to build up these routes. It gets very complicated very quickly, though. And it's just too crunchy, right? It's too much for players to dig into, unless you have
exactly
one of those players who are into it. Again, the nice thing for me is I enjoyed having it as a DM, so that I didn't have to make stuff up on the fly. When they're talking to their, and they had an NPC eventually who just took care of this stuff for them, the NPC could say like, well, I recommend we go to this town or that town. And I could, you know, I wasn't just rolling on a chart. I could give them informed information based on the data I had, essentially being that player for them of the person who's highly engaged in it. There were fun moments in terms of like, well, we could unload this in either Nuln or Altdorf, right? Which one do you guys want to go to?
Yeah.
And it was interesting because in that campaign, there's very specific things happening in each town, and the players would inevitably get involved in those things. More adventuresome, fun, right, stuff. There was that. And then there was also sometimes a trade-off of like, well, we have this much money. I can either buy 2 crates of paper or 10 crates of timber. And it's basically the same cost, and the profit might be different, but it'll take up different amounts of our storage space if we're carrying other stuff. And then also, like, I don't know, paper's a little more dangerous. What if the ship takes on water, right? That's a high price good, but it could easily get ruined.
Okay.
Right?
But, okay. And what about all of that? Right. What about all those paper cuts you could possibly get?
Yeah.
Trousseau chops up.
Yeah. So that was a fun little interaction I got to have with them of like, okay, well, you know, let me just simplify it. Here's 2 choices, players. Here's 2 choices. By paper or timber, which one do you want?
Yeah.
We go to Nuln or Altdorf, which do you think is better? So I enjoyed doing that. Although I guess I like my brain is now skipping to like, could I come up with something that lets me just roll on some charts so I don't have to know the entire, you know, I don't have the giant spreadsheet of the cost of every good in every town.
See, I think that it was, I'm going to give credit to Doug Niles, like I normally do, for making some, I think, some tasteful choices, but not going into the rather obvious level of complexity that you would want in a trading, think about in a complicated trading system. It's just like, table, roll, you get a cargo, now you're in transit, and maybe you get attacked or not. And I think for a couple pages in the core rule book, not having to specify the difference of every single different system in space. I think it was a tasteful choice to get started with. And then, you know, if, like I say, if you find that this is working for you, you can go and expand it to your taste. I think it's a pretty good starting point, honestly.
So this definitely borders into, I know we did an episode once on like trading, right? Trading and economics. Right. And I think we talked about this stuff a bunch. Let me root us back into the general idea of players having a job or an occupation or career outside of adventuring. And the more we talk about this, the more I realize, like, I think it's only enjoyable, one, when it's a shared career or a shared venture amongst the entire party. They all have a stake in the game. And two, when it also then feeds into the adventuring, right? Then it's, you know, the boat trading is interesting because it's forcing us to go to cities where there are adventures to be had, right? As opposed to like, okay, well, now we're in Bogenhofen and there's just nothing going on here, but we spent a bunch of table time traveling here just so that we could sell off our trade goods.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. You know, I'm currently reading Peter Perler's The Art of Wargaming, and usually I wind up with some quote every week that's relevant. And there's a point that he makes where he's talking about the different, and, you know, he's talking about war games, and, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is a war game. We know that. It says it right on the box. So he makes a point of like the different levels of action that you might have in, you know, a game. And you could have lower level tactical stuff where you are, you know, operating one ship or one battalion. You could have higher level campaign operational stuff where you're running a whole campaign or the, you know, a continent-wide issue, or you could have a hybrid game that's kind of in the middle where you do some action at one scale and you do some other action at another scale. And, you know, this is very familiar to what we're talking about now with, you know, possibly running businesses or a D&D game evolving domains. And one of the things that he observes about war games like that, about specifically hybrid war games, and he points out a couple times, he says, the principal difficulty involved in such hybrid games is their potential for allowing the player to fall between two stools. And maybe the particular player not being really good at either one, or emphasizing one or the other in a way that damages the original one. And the thing that he points out in particular is that it's very common for if you have two different levels, and maybe you've got a war game where you want to focus on one thing more than the other, is that players usually tend to grab onto the lower level action and neglect the higher level action, because the lower level action is more familiar, more concrete, and it feels like something that they can engage with in kind of a clearer way in their brain. And even says, like, in things in defense departments, you're trying to do a high-level operational thing, but you can't actually get the admirals and the generals in to war game it. And as a result, you get lower-level officers in, and they focus on the stuff that they're familiar with, which is lower-level issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that at least highlights wanting to be thoughtful when you do start having two multiple levels of play in your campaign. And maybe this is a good thing, right? We've come initially to play, you know, one-on-one role-playing of a particular character. This is familiar to us. This is actually our goal in the first place. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe veering towards a fairly abstract higher level that, like you're saying, Paul, feeds into specific action at the role-playing level, maybe that's the best thing you can possibly do most of the time.
Yeah, I guess I'd buy that. It's interesting what you're saying about just like, sorry, my brain is kind of lost here on the idea that like they couldn't get the admirals to the table to do the high-level right? action stuff. Right? And we've talked about
a really interesting observation
in the past with trying to separate these things, right? And saying like, okay, well, when we're all at the table together, we're going to focus on the low level action.
Yeah.
And then maybe separately, asynchronously via email or something, I will engage with the handful of players mm-hmm. or a single player who is interested in the high level stuff. And we'll do that off to the side, kind of off camera. And then that will feed into the
game. That's a really good idea. I think that's a really good idea of how to do that. And then you can get the subset of players that are interested in it engaging with it properly.
Yeah. Interesting. Dan, we're out of time. Any final thoughts on jobs in D&D or other RPGs?
Yeah. I think that you made a really good observation right there at the end, is that I think it is the businesses and the jobs are a good idea as a possible side game for a subset of interested players. It can be great for like solo play or solo play by email or something like that. You know, if you have a player that was part of your group and they moved away and they can't be part of your tabletop sessions and you're playing live, you could have a side game where they're still engaged and having some effect on the campaign. Maybe they become the merchant captain or something like that. It's definitely something you don't want to force on your existing role-playing group without advanced buy-in. And you want to think about, where is the abstraction level? Do your players want to be disengaged, non-managing partners in a business? And they just fund money goes in, money comes out, and that's a very highly abstract thing. Or are they actually on the merchant ship and have a system where you do want to detail specifically where they're going and exactly what they're hauling at a particular time? Those would be very different systems. And you do kind of want to find out, before you waste time, I guess, developing something like that, you want to find out from your is anybody in your playgroup actually interested in it? And I think starting off really light. Start off with a really light system, right? Maybe just like random roll for cargo and random price. Maybe that's good enough. See if that gets you some traction. And then if someone is interested, start building out the rather obvious economic system of different places and different imports and different exports and surges and gluts. To me, I feel like that actually could be very interesting, but you need a player on the other side that agrees with you.
I mean, and that, of course, you know, that, of course, assumes that you're doing a fairly high level job, right? Like as a merchant or, a tradesman of some kind, right? Like, and I think one of the things that overlooks is stuff like, well, I'm just a craftsman. I'm just an armorer. I just make armor and I sell it, right? And I feel like the latter, especially the stuff that focuses on a single individual. I guess that's the major key I'm taking away from here is like it can be fun as long as it involves the entire group and not just one individual.
Yes,
you're involving one individual, especially if you know if the worst case of involving one individual is if you're doing it per player, where every player has their one individual thing that they do separately from the rest of the group that has nothing to do with the group and their activities, right? Then I think that is like kind of worst case nightmare scenario. I think jobs or occupations can be.
Yeah. I mean, that can be, I mean, you can think back to like the original Blackmore camp was separate and basically competing. But at that point, you know, it's an online, it's a distance game. You're not actually getting together at the table because there's no point to it. So if you want to be together in a role-playing session, yeah, that's probably the top advice is make sure that everyone's engaged, involved with it.
Because that's the little piece of advice from the Warhammer book that keeps nagging at me is this like, oh, well, make sure as you're planning your career path that you're talking to the GM and figuring out how it integrates into the campaign. And I just think that's too much load on the GM. If the GM has to do this for every individual player, that is too much load. But it can be interesting if it's just one thing, right? If it's just, okay, my players as a group have decided that they're going to become, you know, river merchants. Cool. Now I can figure out as GM what level of abstraction to play that at and how that feeds into the major content of the adventure that I want to play that has nothing to do with river trade.
That makes a lot of sense. There's one sentence on that point that I want to pull up. Again, this would be from the Star Frontiers campaign. If you can pull up the image with a blue dot on it. This is, I think this is Dragon number 93-ish, I think. And this is, for what it's worth, this is the article that expands the freight hauling trade economic activity to agricultural goods. And they go through liquors and wines and herbs and medicinals. And at the end of the article, it has this kind of meta rule of the really high price stuff has to be on the ground on a specific planet environment. You can't grow it on like a satellite or something like that. And it said, the last paragraph says, rules for on-planet farming have been omitted for several reasons. Devising a system like that would be beyond the scope of this piece. But more importantly, the players shouldn't be encouraged to take on the role of farmers. After all, they're supposed to be adventurous. So just be cognizant of backing yourself into a situation where the campaign becomes the most boring occupation possible. don't do that. And if your rules have to say it's just not economically feasible, then do so in order to prevent them from doing that. Completely mundane job. Probably not the best thing. There ought to be a reason why they're adventuring. I agree with that advice.
Yes. Yeah. 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 I like, you know, I'm sorry, we're going into extra innings here, but like, I like this, the take of, say, DCC of taking the core little piece of Warhammer and just saying like, well, it's fun as a background. It's fun as a little context. And frankly, we saw D&D 5th edition do this as well with their backgrounds, right? I got a section here from the 5th edition thing and it talks about, you know, here's your background. You roll up. Maybe you were a sage or an artisan or a soldier in the past. But then the little piece I highlighted here is it says, great, this is going to ask you certain story cues about your character's identity. Why did you stop doing whatever your background describes and start adventuring? Right? It's clearly making the distinction of you did this in the past, but it is over now because now you're adventuring. And my personal favorite reason for any of this is the very easy reason of saying like, well, all the careers that I was given, all the backgrounds I'm given as an option are terrible. They're all like really poor paying, really miserable experience. And I got this opportunity to go on this wild adventure, strike it rich. That's my favorite. Like, yeah, why wouldn't you? Yeah, I've been a turnip farmer for a decade and it sucks. And you're telling me we can go raid this dragon's den and be, you know, live like kings? Oh, yeah.
There's your backstory. I support this backstory. That's what you want.
Totally. Viewers, if you have opinions on careers or jobs or occupations for your characters outside of adventuring, Or I've other know of other systems we didn't touch on here that give rules for that that might be in line with the kind of stuff we're looking for, please leave a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe you'll expose us to something new that we hadn't thought of, and it'll spin off part two of this discussion down the road.
Absolutely. And like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and GitHub and places like that. We have the handle WANDYMs on all those sites, so please fire that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com, and also through various third-party carriers such as Spotify and iTunes and Stitcher and a variety of others. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those third-party sites and the site offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, we'll be on our private Discord server in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation or after chat like we do every Sunday. Every tier on Patreon gets you access to that Discord server. So even a single dollar, we would love to see you there on our Discord server and continue the conversation throughout the week about this topic and a whole bunch of other stuff, including sci-fi and horror and miniatures and all the kinds of stuff that we and our viewers adore. So we'll be there on our Discord server in about 10 minutes, like we said. I will be back Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time for another session of Dan's Old Time Mini Show. And I will start making a mold for talking about Star Frontiers. I'm going to start making the evil villains of Star Frontiers, namely the Wormy Sathar. And so that's going to be the biggest miniature that I've made so far from those player characters. And we'll see if I can get a mold going for that. But of course, don't forget, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.